it's very, very important to just serve what's going on in the big equation. As we say, we are the backbone. If you keep running, you just miss the soul.
This is The Process, and I'm Laurent John.
In the first encyclopedias of music, drums are classified as noise and are placed as being somehow inferior.
What do you call someone who hangs around with musicians? The answer? A drummer. And let's face it, how much has changed? The drummer's still the punchline, but that history runs pretty deep.
Those stereotypes are incredibly old, but they're absolutely reinforced and consolidated through the transatlantic slave trade and the dehumanization of West African people, but also their cultural practices.
There's not a culture I can think of that doesn't have a version of the drums, percussion. It's very sort of human. The obvious thing is relation to a heartbeat. It's very physical. And so I suppose it was just a natural thing I've been thinking about instrument-wise.
In this episode of The Process, Somerset House Studios artist Apal Jr. Boache Adam is looking at the drums through a new frame.
The reason why I decided to make it visible, this sort of initial learning being visible, is the fact that there's a level of performance with visual art, because you're having to present something. And you're always having to show the best you. And so I was quite interested in how that works in terms of opportunities, how that works in terms of labour. And I was also interested in how that works in terms of presentation, always having to present yourself as best as possible. I try and think of ways of breaking that.
Apal Jr. Boache Adam works across a multidisciplinary practice, creating installations where the mediums are ever-evolving and constantly in conversation with each other. He joined the studio's community in 2023 as the inaugural recipient of the Donna Linus Residency. This residency is supported by Modern Art Oxford, Somerset House Studios, South London Gallery, and Wising Arts Centre, and offers a 3-year salary with support from each partner, including mentoring, use of facilities, and inclusion in public programmes. Junior works predominantly with sound, photography, and video. But since 2020, he's been learning the drums. At the start, he made his learning process very visible, building it into his performance and installing himself within the gallery space to practice.
What happens if I just want to learn something? What happens then?
But increasingly, he started to conceal his playing behind photographic panels.
This opens up this idea of a humility, a not knowing or not presenting yourself in this sort of polished or finished way.
And there's one caveat. He only practices the drums when he has institutional support.
That's when I decided to learn playing the drums, and I'm going to learn when the work is given support, whether that be financial, space, any type of support in which allows my learning to continue. And when I'm not given that space for that to happen, the drums get packed away, gets put into storage until the next time I'm given that support.
This got him thinking about the ways time manifests through his playing, through his body, and through the drum kit itself.
So one thing I've been thinking about recently is how the drums allow you to travel across different times, both in the body as you're keeping time, but also through the history of music. It's the rhythm that marks out all the distinct popular genres of the 20th century. Just think jazz, R&B, rock and roll, drum and bass, disco, house, and so forth. So in this podcast, I want to explore whether or how the drums can be a time-travelling device.
How can the drum kit allow us to time travel? Firstly, through the body, from teacher to student, and then across history and geography, from New Orleans to Istanbul.
When you learn the drums of a teacher, you begin to embody them in some way, physically mimicking and picking up their mannerisms or style of playing. Over time, those movements become part of you and how you play, and eventually you make it your own, reshaping those gestures. Is the body of the drummer in itself taking part in a form of time travel?
And what's the grip? Do you like the jazz grip or the the rock, like the symmetric grip? Okay.
Valentina Magaletti, I first saw at Cafe Otto.
So have you been doing like paradiddles and all of that?
Paradiddles.
I say she's one of the most inventive drummers around at the moment. She plays with lots of her own projects, Holy Tongue, Moyen, Rame, as well as people like Mika Levy, Can, and Thurston Moore.
The first thing that I fell in love with were the ghost note, like the bouncing.
So it's like pushing in.
What I love about her playing is how, in some records, there's a sense of process, but also it feels like she just lets things happen. I'm interested in how she moves between those two, between learning something and following the rules and then breaking them.
Lots of people ask me, what's your favourite drummers, da 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 da. And I do have like the usual suspect or whatever, or the more like obscure and free jazz and stuff. But a lot of time it happens to me to see some bands where the drummer is obviously not trained or like or just started. And I find it incredible, very inspiring the way, because it's so fresh. Nobody told you how to approach something. You're just going to try things and it can lead to really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I recommend 10 minutes of this every day.
Okay, sure.
Seriously, until you get to this stage. Yeah, because then when then it will be really natural to do what I
am. I'm quite interested in this idea of knowledge and how that's communicated and how that's passed on. The question really is like what sort of teachers you had and what sort of was a good thing that they taught you that stuck with you and that you sort of go to maybe.
I think there is two different kind of knowledge when it comes to this. There is technical knowledge, and that's kind of sterile because everyone follows the same book, you know, in southern Italy back in the days. Initially, really, I had a sort of technical approach to it. But what really drew me into was the spiritual approach. The shamanic approach, the primal approach. And then I started like, wow, this instrument actually keeps giving. It's not just about gravity blast and testosterone and like, oh, and just like hitting stuff, which is really therapeutic. And I recommend it to you to do what I do. It's so like primal and it belongs to everyone. Everyone can like kick a ball. It's the same with percussions in a way. Not many people actually are privileged enough to own a drum kit or to have a space to make noise, but everyone can at any point just hit like something that sounds and it's like, oh wow, this feels good.
Although everybody can kick a ball and it's like, it's still different ways in which people manage it. That's what makes a good player.
Exactly.
From, like any sport is like how you do that thing within the
And it resonates. Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's quite a visible thing when I've seen yourself and other people that are playing. It's like you actually start watching what they do.
Yeah.
The more I develop, the more different ways I find in concealing myself.
Yeah.
So normally I'm concealed. I'm not visible. Whenever I'm doing something live or it's in present, I'm not visible. And I'm finding ways in which to conceal myself just because I'm thinking about visibility in terms of various things. So like as a black man, this is visibility and understanding the position of your visibility.
But it's important,
no? It's important.
It's so crucial.
But at the same time, I suppose I've understood that in a sort of art context, it can be abused or it can be used as like a...
Only if exploited.
Yeah.
Because as a queer woman, like they can totally exploit the fact. Mm. But minorities as such, especially in art, needs to be out there and outspoken there. You can always get a really good light engineer. I always say, like, just keep the light down, loads of smoke, you know?
But I suppose it's this idea of, I'm sort of thinking about ideas of tokenism in some way. And in what ways do you consider that when you're playing in terms of, you know, visibility? What does that mean for you when you're playing?
I think that's the bit that is the most maybe contagious for other people because they see how liberating it is. I often, when I listen to my thing, I shout a lot, like when they play tennis, ah, ah. Yeah. And I think people kind of gain that. It's like, oh my God, I want to, you know. And so I think it's important to have some visibility just in terms of like how to resonate with what you do. Mm. I think because other people looking at what you do, they say, I want to do that.
So it's like it can be like a moment of inspiring others.
I think so.
It was interesting to talk to Valentina on how she thinks about visibility. One thing I've been thinking through with the drums is who gets to be visible and who gets cut out of the frame.
The classic drummer joke is sort of, what do you call someone who hangs around with musicians? The answer, a drummer, of course. And this is actually an extremely old joke. You can trace it through the 20th century into the 19th. And the earliest instance of someone kind of making that, oh, drummers aren't real musicians. The first example I could find was from 1511.
I came across the writer and social musicologist Matt Brennan's book, Kick It, A Social History of the Drum Kit, which lays out how the instrument has evolved from the 1900s onwards. What you cover in your book is this, the parallels between the drum history itself and the stereotypical idea of a drummer. And I'm quite interested in the parallels between that and a sort of African diaspora, you know, across the US. The othering that's aligned with the drums and with particular culture.
If you look at music history books, for instance, from the 19th century, they map this kind of evolution of music from the quote-unquote primitive or savage musical practices up to the apex of musical achievement, which of course is kind of Euro-classical early 19th century repertoire. And drums get classified very explicitly, like in the first encyclopedias of music. If you look at its first edition in the 19th century, drums are, you know, classified as noise, as opposed to being musical instruments which are pitched, right? But things like cymbals and drums kind of get moved over to one side and are placed as being somehow inferior. But that's, of course, coded language for, like, the cultural practices that go into the performance of that instrument are not to be valued. And that matters because if you're to dehumanize an entire culture and an entire people, you need to make sure that you're devaluing any cultural expression of that people as well.
And of course, if drummers were going to be considered real musicians in the Western classical mode, they needed to be able to read music.
One of the most famous drum manufacturers in the early 20th century is Ludwig. And William F. Ludwig, the creator of that company, he really strongly felt that in order for drummers to be considered legitimate musicians, they had to be able to read notation. They had to be able to play the part without deviating from it, to respect the composer, and to put performers in a subordinate position. At the same time, you have jazz culture, which is breaking every one of those rules, and where the creativity and the value in that music lies in, okay, how can we do something more interesting than the actually quite boring drum part that's being notated for us? And this tension arises in the 1920s. There are, in musical cultures in both North America and in Europe, this idea of like kind of two different ways of learning, but also like two different skill sets that are valued in different ways. The ability, basically, to improvise and deviate gets labeled as faking in these circles, and that term starts to spread. In order to play jazz, you have to be a good faker, quote unquote, right? We automatically assume means inauthentic, illegitimate, inferior, but actually, faking is actually suggesting, to my mind, some pretty valued and important musical techniques that end up defining most of the music in the 20th century that people actually listen to and remember.
That idea of improvisation, I did a fine art thing, and it's like you learn, it's very much an emphasis to begin with on discipline and how you learn certain things.
It's funny you say that because I picked up not long ago a book that I find incredible that is like Mistakes on Fine Art. And I find that it was the best art of it. Yeah. It's not just to be like art brute or like outsider. It's just destroying conventions, and you get to points that is like, wow, why not? At least, like, we're doing a creative thing, so why not? I find it crazy to give yourself limitations, you know? When musicians in the orchestra say, oh, can I really do that with the cello? It's like, mate, like, you have to, why not? Yeah. Another exercise I love that is very simple in a way.
Notation is actually a really poor tool for capturing what constitutes good drumming.
Oh. It seems really easy, but when you study... It's actually quite tricky.
Yeah.
Let's try it.
Okay, let me try that.
Will give you a lot of room for coordination.
I could write down, okay, you play your bass drum on beat one, your snare drum on beat two, your bass drum on beat three, and your snare drum on beat four. But, you know, some drummers come up through a style of learning where they're adept at reading notation, but many do not. Artists like, say, the Beatles, for instance. Paul McCartney is on record many, many times saying notation is not his thing.
I think it's very, very important to just serve what's going on in the big equation. As we say, we are the backbone. So it's like, it's great to serve the song as opposed to just run towards nothing. If you keep running, you just miss the soul.
So one essential role for any drummer is timekeeping, keeping on track to time. What I've found whilst learning, when that learning has become muscle memory, it goes into this rhythm and where you sort of lose track of time. But how did this role come about? And can a drummer's perception of time shift whilst playing?
When you're behind the drum kit, or when you're listening to the drum kit and dancing to it, it alters your sense of time. You are no longer living in clock time. You are embodying a sense of time that is circular in some ways. It's a loop. The drums in most band settings are providing a groove. It's this steady timekeeping feel that gets us out of, oh, I've got to be here at 9:30, I've got to be here at 10 o'clock, into experiencing time in a completely different way. The psychologist Csikszentmihalyi talks about flow states when people are kind of in the zone, be that just stuck into any practice that kind of alters that sense of time for them. To me, the drum kit is a very powerful way to enter a flow state, whether you're a listener or indeed a performer. Once you're in that other sort of time, this more circular or groove time, this is where, to my mind, great drummers can be identified through a distinctive time feel. The way that they perform and play with time is really what makes them distinctive. And if you're trying to learn to be a jazz drummer, you really need to get stuck into, okay, like, when I'm playing this groove, am I playing behind the beat or ahead of the beat or directly on it with my feet versus my hands? I saw a really interesting study recently that was looking at the drumming of Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. You have a lot of people thinking, okay, well, what's Charlie's time feel? And there was a really cool study looking at other famous drummers who were saying, oh yeah, Charlie plays ahead of the beat consistently. And another drummer said, no, Charlie plays behind the beat consistently. And Stuart Copeland of The Police, another incredible drummer, said, actually what he's doing is he's playing ahead of the beat with his left hand, he's playing behind the beat with his right foot, and it's creating this tension. And then someone did this computational analysis. They fed all of the Stones records into a computer, isolated the drums, and sure enough, Stuart Copeland was right. I think you could make a similar case for what makes so many of the drummers that we remember and that are significant in culture distinctive. They do something to our sense of time. It's a combination of how they hear time, how that expresses itself in their bodies, to very things like their arms and their legs. You know, when you see a graceful athlete, there's a technique, but then there's also this artistry and this beauty to it. In the drummers, that comes out as organizing time differently.
Perhaps it's because the drum can be so powerful that the instrument has been sidelined or excluded from the narrative. drums have had a very strong presence when it comes to stories of resistance right across the globe.
The drum kit is kind of a perfect storm of an instrument that threatens imperial Euro-white culture at the turn of the 20th century and is treated as such. Drums are seen as a threat, and this comes through very clearly in the African diaspora on slave plantations in the United States and the colonies that led up to the United States. Also in the Caribbean, drums were forbidden from use on plantations in Barbados, Jamaica, St. Kitts, and areas of the United States. The drums were, of course, used in different West African cultures for musical and religious practices, but also to communicate across distances. If we go back to, say, the American Civil War, drums were very present on the battlefield in that war. Lots of drums were produced and lots of people were trained up to play drums. Then after the Civil War, you suddenly have a whole lot of instruments hanging around cities. These instruments, because they've been produced at scale, become a bit more affordable and they start to move their way into non-military practices. When the slave trade happens, you have people from different cultures speaking different languages with different musical traditions across West Africa who are then lumped together, and this new hybrid form of specifically African-American expression starts to develop over the course of many decades. That moves over and translates into parade bands, effectively, which were, of course, segregated at this moment in history. But suddenly, this new syncopated rendition that involves more rhythmic complexity, that involves improvisation, involves active, willful misuse of instruments that sounds kind of jazzy. And New Orleans is the location in which that kind of first occurs, and then, of course, spreads in the early 20th century as populations from a hostile Black South move up to urban centers like Chicago and New York specifically. And suddenly those musical practices move into other settings, into dance halls. And then by the end of World War I, you have this thing called jazz.
This is what I love about the drums. They ricochet through so many different histories. In the US, from the battlefield, then subverted by the enslaved, in New Orleans, practicing all sorts of polyrhythms, which you can then hear in the birth of jazz in the cities like New York. So this makes me think back to the visual art history and practices with the use of the ready-made objects and how that's similar in that way, or it can be included in that history of the visual art practice of ready-made objects, using an object in a new way or using it where it might have been redundant and giving it a new form of life in which there's no expectations as to what that new thing can be. You've played lots of different sorts of percussion. Could you tell us a bit about other percussion instruments or accompaniments that you've played with?
When I was in this duo called Tomaga, I found a wok from IKEA or something. And I realized that it was like universally screwable in any boom stand. And I had that wok for so long because it was just like, oh, you know what, I'm gonna get a pan, put a contact mic on it and making it a proper like instrument. And it had so many different like frequency and so much fun. Right. And since then, I started collecting all the thing that could actually make sounds. Anything from a nail jar, from like chains. I approached a drum kit that was not just like skin, but for example, made of porcelain. The first time I approached that, I was like, oh wow, this is fantastic. This is a very fragile material, a bit further than just conventionally drumming on it. So I started experimenting with rubber, for example. And the rubber applied to porcelain gave me like a cello sound. So I had like, ooh. Respect of the real simple object is what I love, because it's endless. I love this on the hat. You can... You know, whoever came up with the hi-hat, it's really clever, because you can have, like, so many sounds just out of the pressure of the thing. And then you can have, like, an open-up sound, a closed sound, and then all the different accent. I rate the hat a lot.
So despite the sheer creativity that drummers like Valentina can perform with, and bring to innovating and adapting their instruments. Much of their work of drumming has historically been disregarded. Their contributions are left formally unrecognized.
Folk who have written a song or created a recording of that song, what's privileged in terms of being able to make a case for this as a distinct piece of copyrightable work is traditionally the lyric and the melody, never the rhythm. You can imagine a completely different history of music if the drum kit and memorable performances on it were considered to be part of the copyright of particular songs. Clyde Stubblefield, who performed drums with James Brown and is the most sampled drummer of all time, yet doesn't have any songwriting credits, even though in many cases it's only his isolated drum part that is being reproduced for hip-hop records and dance records going forward in the late 20th century.
When you say that, it does make you think of course, technology. We're talking about this time-traveling thing, so there's a sense it can travel to the past as well as the future. Practices, I suppose, shamanism, in which you're sort of evoking spirits of the past in some respect. But there's this idea that it can travel to the future, something I'm quite interested to look at as well, thinking about how it marks these cultural shifts. I just wanted to know different ways in which the drums have marked cultural shifts, and also how the drum machine has also played a part in that.
If we think about what is the turning point for, say, traditional dance music in the early 20th century versus jazz or ragtime or bebop or rhythm and blues or funk or soul or hip hop or house or disco, you could make a pretty convincing argument that actually the fundamental differentiating musical characteristic is what's happening on the drums. But then also, they're tied to technology, and there are sometimes different sounds. So it might be that someone is laying down a steady 4-4 on the kick drum in the 1960s in Motown beats, but you can't hear it because the recording studio isn't equipped to be able to push that up into the mix. By the time you move into the 1970s, suddenly you're moving from like 2- and 4-track recording to 24-track recording. That means the kick drum gets its own channel on a mixing board. And what happens with Giorgio Moroder and others is they think, okay, I would like to hear some more kick drum, please. Let's see if we can push that up on this fader as much as possible. And let's get Donna Summer to sing over top of it. And suddenly you have maybe not even a different beat, but a different prominence of the sounds of the drum kit in the mix. The trajectory of 20th century music as one where the sounds of the kick and snare and cymbals move from a marginal position in a sound mix, where they're like at the back of the room, at the bottom of the mix. By the end of the 20th century, they're front and center, the vocal and the kick and the snare. That's the foundation of a pop record.
That's really interesting. You know, when you say that, it does make me think about this idea of when I think about time traveling, is the fact that the drums is like this marker to a sonic change. You know, whenever you think of like moments, the rhythm and the sound of the drums is the thing that makes you identify sort of a time. Oh, that sound is from the 80s or from this thing, or you know.
Absolutely. The drum machine was never meant to be a featured instrument. It was meant to be a practice technology for guitarists or piano players. It wasn't designed to be this new sound that would give birth to a whole genre of music. But as we've seen throughout the history of the drum kit, drummers take technologies that are made for one purpose and they insert creativity to it and use it for another purpose. Pioneers of house and techno, hip-hop artists like Jay Dilla. These people are using the sound of the kick, snare, and cymbals in new ways. I count them as drummers. And of course, when those new sonic signifiers first appear, they sound like the future. In the 21st century, you do see these shifts where suddenly, if you're a pop star, you may be hiring a producer who's known for great beats as much as you might hire someone to craft a melody for you or to write a catchy lyric. And they will be recognized in copyright. The drum kit, if you look at its history, it charts that shift to a point where that labor wasn't being recognized, to a point where we are now, where hopefully it is more often.
What's the best piece of advice a teacher that you've had, or anybody that a colleague or anybody who in your field of playing has given you?
There's no teacher that I get the best advice for music, because it's a constant, constant learning process. And what I love about it is, like, one day is really different from the other. It's just like embroidered in what you do every day. Just go day by day, hoping that it's a constant, open and inclusive dialogue. And
learning something new.
Yeah.
That process is at the heart of why I see.
Exactly.
I wanted to have something that allowed me to continuously...
That's it.
...change and develop, and that doesn't end. That just...
That's it. I think that's if that can be the advice, then that's it. The continuum of what we're doing is what keeps it magical.
Thanks to Apo Jr. Boacce-Adam, Valentino Magaletti, and Matt Brennan. This episode of The Process was produced by Alana Chance, Maylee Evans, and Tess Davidson. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The theme music is by Car Beard, and the series is mixed by Mike Willey. My name is Laurent John. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, make sure you subscribe so the latest episodes jump straight into your podcast app. Thanks for listening. And finally, looking for some creative inspiration this spring? Assembly, the experimental sound and music series from Somerset House Studios, returns with an expansive 3-day program of new performances, installation, and talks from the 26th to the 28th of March. We'd love to see you there.